My name is Keely Kinsey and I'm a proud Indigenous woman of the Wathaurong tribe. On behalf of the Call It Out podcast, we would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we meet upon today, the Wathaurong people of the Kulin Nation. We would like to pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging and acknowledge the sovereignty was never ceded. The Call It Out podcast acknowledges the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognises a continuing connection to lands, waterways and communities.
Call It Out is a podcast led by students from Sacred Heart College and St. Joseph's College in Geelong. Listening through the lens of young people, the podcast episodes are an insightful journey into contemporary issues impacting them, discussing the themes such as gender equality, unhealthy masculinity, everyday sexism, healthy relationships and consent. We are given an intimate invitation into what young people think.
Three, two, one.
My name is Destiny. I go by she, her pronouns.
My name is Georgia. I go by she, her pronouns.
And my name is Alex. I go by she, they pronouns.
We are very excited to have Jane on the podcast today. Jane Gilmore is an author, journalist, feminist, and consent educator. She has been researching and writing about the causes and effects of violence against women for over a decade, and is now also involved in delivering consent and respectful relationships in education in Australian schools. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Awesome. So just to start off, talking about the Fix It Violence and the Representation of Women in the Media program that you've been running, can you explain why you started the campaign Fix It?
At the time, I was a journalist. I was doing a lot of freelancing and I was writing a lot about the way that men's violence against women was portrayed in the media, that it was often erasing the perpetrators, putting responsibility back on the victims. It was implicit victim blaming. And I was writing lots of articles about it at the time that were not really having any cut through. And I was on a tram one day and a headline came up on my feed. It's a long time ago, but it was something like police say selfie led to stabbing murder, something like that. And selfies, of course, do not cause murder. And once again, they had completely erased the perpetrator, or at the time, the alleged perpetrator, from the headline. So instead of writing an article about it, I just crossed it out and rewrote the headline and put it out to social media and then forgot about it. And then the next time I picked up my phone, it kind of exploded in my hands. And I thought, quite literally, a picture is worth a thousand words, because those thousand words articles that I'd been writing hadn't been doing anything. And this one picture was just such a clear way of demonstrating what the problem was and how easy it was to write a headline that still told the story and summarised it all, but was actually accurate. Yeah. So that was how it started. And it's effective. It works. It has contributed to the change in the way the media reports this stuff, I think. So it became an obsession and then something I just couldn't let go of. And now it's a habit, I think, more than anything else.
You speak about something called passive voice in your book, Descriptions. What does that term mean in the terms of the work that you do?
Passive voice is something that really, Journalism 101 is you don't ever use the passive voice. It's the sort of phrasing that doesn't give any action to the sentence. It is believed, it was done, rather than he did it or she said it, which is the active voice. And it makes sentences less clear because it doesn't give a clear focus and object to the sentence and makes the meaning harder to determine. It's often a way of avoiding expressing opinion, I think, is sometimes why journalists do it. And if there's cases that are still before a court, it can sometimes be a bit more tricky in that you have to put the word allegedly in. I don't understand why this is difficult, but apparently it is. So putting really, really clear sentences into your copy is supposed to be the main function of journalism. We are supposed to write words that people clearly understand what we're trying to communicate. So this is why using the passive voice is so often discouraged. And it only really seems to come up when they're writing about men's violence against women.
Yeah, definitely. So do you think you've noticed some of these tones being set in anything written about your own work?
Not really. Most of the responses that I get is either positive. The best one that I ever receive, which I do fairly often, is, oh, wow, I hadn't seen that before, but now that you've pointed it out, I see it everywhere. And seeing people pushing back before I get the opportunity to do it, or I get the "but not all men" crowd who are just boring, or sometimes journalists trying to defend it, you don't understand the requirements of court reporting. And I think, well, if you're trying to avoid including the fact that there is an accused or a perpetrator in this story, then you don't understand the requirements of court reporting. There are very strict requirements, and there are a lot of things that journalists have to be very, very careful about when they're reporting on crimes that are before the courts. But assuming that the victim is lying or that it's her fault is absolutely not part of their job.
Is this sort of thing, the title Misconceptions, something that you see even in feminist or more progressive articles?
Absolutely. It happens across the entire media. It's not concentrated. Well, it's probably more common in some of the tabloid press, but I've seen terrible reporting in The Guardian. The ABC used to have some truly awful headlines and some truly awful reporting. They've made a significant effort to improve over the last few years, which is obvious in the change in their reporting. But certainly when I started Fixed It, it was absolutely across the board.
Do you think it's coded that deep into our media?
I think it's starting to change. I think habits die hard, and journalists like to think of themselves as progressive and forward-thinking and always in touch with what's going on, but it can be quite a conservative profession. And changing those habits, those sensationalist headlines, the "but he was such a good guy" trope, using the passive voice in reporting on crimes against women committed by men, those things are hard to break. The one that comes up a lot still, say, is the habit of replacing either the perpetrator or the victim with the location of the crime. So they'll talk about the laneway rapist, the bungalow rapist, the Carlton rapist. Carlton was not raped, a woman was. So those kind of things are really ingrained, and it takes a while to change them. But the thing also that has changed in the last, say, 20 years in journalism is that subscribers are so important to publications now. Sorry, I've got a puppy on my lap, which is making it hard to concentrate. Subscribers are so important to newspapers now. It used to be advertising, or to not newspapers, but news outlets. They used to be entirely dependent on advertising, and that's not really the case anymore. So they have to be a lot more responsive to subscribers. So I think the pushback from the public has a lot more of an effect now, because that relationship is so much more important to them. So, yes, I think it's changing, and change always takes time, unfortunately. But I've certainly seen an improvement over the last 7 years, without a doubt.
Do you think you've seen that sort of change in your own work? Like, do you think in your earlier days you might have noticed, going back on your earlier work, that maybe you used that sort of language and you've pulled yourself up on it?
I think when I look back at some of the earlier Fixed It posts, I certainly didn't know nearly as much about it as I know now. There were some things that I wasn't picking up on, because you get so used to it that you don't notice when that sort of really implicit victim blaming or some of those passive voice things, you have to really sort of train yourself to look for it, which is certainly much easier now than it was in the beginning. And I definitely know a lot more about the legal requirements, the defamation and sub judice contempt issues that do restrict the way journalists can report on those kind of crimes. I've spent years making sure I learned as much as I can possibly find out about those things. So certainly the fixes that I do now, I think, are more accurate, but much better informed. But it's taken a long time to learn all that.
Do you have any feedback, do you think, for young people on, obviously, if things aren't being reported the right way in the media, of a way that they can then look at that and work out how, what is actually happening, what's the real story happening here, a better way to educate themselves even?
It's difficult. It's critical thinking is crucial. It's always looking at everything that you read and think, what is this saying? What is this story telling me, or whatever you're listening to or watching? What are they telling me? Why are they telling me? And what are they not telling me? And those three questions will really get to the bottom of it. Sometimes if it's something that's really important to you, you can often find with big stories, they'll be covered by a number of different organisations. So if I read something that I think is probably not including as much information as it could or it should, I'll have a look and see if the case was reported somewhere else and see what else the other people are saying about it. If you really want to go to extreme lengths, you can ask the court for transcripts if it's a court case, those kind of things. And as far as correcting information, I mean, journalists are not the sole providers of information anymore. It's really, we are not dependent on them. They are certainly useful and I think crucial in a democracy, because you need to have people whose entire day is devoted to finding out information and passing it on to other people. But we all have the capacity to find out information now and to pass it on to other people. And again, the pressure is on journalism to make itself useful. And if it's not doing that, and if other people are serving that purpose, then they become irrelevant. So I think if young people are seeing things that are not giving them the information they want, that finding it in other places and spreading that around on social media teaches journalists that either, you know, keep up or get out of the way, basically.
Yeah, completely. Do you think that then social media, would you say, is a really vital tool for young people to utilise, I guess, if they're trying to find fresh sources for them?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know the perils of social media. I'm sure I don't need to go over those for you. But I think often in all the big scary stories about the terrible things that happen on social media, we overlook what a powerful positive tool it can be for finding other people who have similar interests or similar concerns. They may not necessarily be in your physical location, but you can almost always find somebody who's got the same interests that you do online. And sharing information, sharing techniques on finding out more information, all those kind of things, and then, as I said, passing that information that you found out onto other people. You know, it's not like the good old days where you'd have to photocopy it at the school library and hand it out by hand. You know, it's so easy to move information around now that, yes, I think social media is absolutely vital for that. And certainly Fixed It is evidence of that. If it's had any effect, it is entirely because of social media, because of journalists and editors watching not just what I do, because if it was just me, it would have no effect. But it's the response and the sharing and the fact that they can see that so many other people also see that that's a problem. That's what really has the power. It's not just one person.
And I know that you have a platform on YouTube where you talk about some of the stuff that you work on in your career. I was wondering what kind of response you have on that platform, like in your comments and that sort of thing.
To be honest, I haven't really done much on the YouTube. There was a bit of lockdown stuff. You know, we're all going a bit nuts in lockdown and just it was trying it out. I'm more comfortable with writing. That's my natural medium. To be honest, I get a bit self-conscious making videos and maybe it's journalism background, but I feel like I'm making myself the story and I'm not the story. The issue is the story.
Yeah.
So the comment, if there were comments on it, because I hardly ever go there, I honestly haven't seen them. And I'm so used to, I mean, I spent years on Twitter, particularly in the early days when I was using it a lot. And I mean, I'm so used to those kind of negative comments now that they just honestly water off a duck's back. I just don't care whether some stranger thinks I'm too fat to write, because, you know, like, just go away, honestly.
Yeah, that's not the focus. That's not what it's about.
It really doesn't affect me. It did in the beginning. It was hard in the beginning, but after a while you just get used to it and you realise that this is somebody who doesn't know me and has never met me and doesn't know anything about me or my work, so why would I care what they think?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have anything that I guess you would say to anyone who wanted to put their voice out there, you know, how to respond to then, I guess, to getting negative comments from people, how you, I guess, approached it as well?
I think everybody responds in different ways. Clem will call them out, laugh at them, make them part of the story, which, you know, I mean, I don't do it, but I can absolutely see the point of it. I tend to ignore them because, honestly, I'm so busy I really don't have the time to play. But every now and again, if I'm bored, I might have a laugh. But they just, they don't hold my interest enough. I will, you know, I like a really good discussion. I like smart people who come up with points that I haven't thought of before and who are interested in actually discussing something rather than just yelling insults, which, again, is just stupid and boring. So I think it's a matter of finding what works for you. Some people just block and delete and move on. Some people want to get into it and feel like they're making some kind of response. I think it's, there's not one set way that absolutely works. I think you have to find the way that works for you. And also recognize that it's different at different times. You know, there are some times when maybe you're a bit more fragile or a bit more vulnerable and they can get through a bit more. Sometimes, you know, turn off the phone or go to a different platform, do something else for a while. I think the most important thing to remember, though, is that in my experience, somebody who's really trolling you is somebody who's looking for a reaction. They're doing it because they want to upset you. Laughing at them seems to be the thing that gets them the most upset themselves, because they want you to be upset. They want to feel powerful, that they're getting a strong reaction from you. And if you're ignoring them or laughing at them, then they're not getting that power. They're not getting that sense of, I've done something, I got to her. And that's usually the most effective way of taking that power away from them. I mean, it's all that kind of stuff is about power. It's a form of violence, and violence is always about power.
I guess this might not be directly related to Fixed It, but it is on the topic of violence and the representation of women in the media. But do you have any sort of advice for women who go onto social media regularly and see that they're getting put down all the time by men? As an example, you've got Andrew Tate, who just, it's just awful. And it can be very disheartening.
It can, yeah. The tater tots are, I mean, they just get exhausting after a while. I think, you know, social media is one of the advantages of it is you can kind of curate your feed in the right places. So I tend to follow a lot of women whose work I think is interesting or fun or good. I follow men who don't tend to attract the tater tot types. It is exhausting and really dispiriting to see that constant putting down that does exist in some of those places. I guess it's really important to remember that it's specific places. It's like if you walk into a cafe that's full of idiots, you don't force yourself to stay there. You think, ugh, and you go and find yourself a better place to stay, you know, to sit down and have your coffee and do whatever you're going to do. So I tend to treat the internet in the same way, because there are actually a lot of really positive places where people don't talk about women like that, where they are really positive and strong and encouraging, and reminding yourself that those places exist as well, because otherwise it can feel like that's all there is. I think that's really important.
Yeah, 100%.
So back to your Fixed It campaign, was there a point where you went, oh my gosh, this is really like taken off, you know, and what was that like for you, seeing that you were making such a difference, changing headlines?
Well, like I said, that first one really went off at the time, and that did take me by surprise, because I didn't expect it. It was just a moment of frustration that I completely forgot about. I suppose when I was approached about writing the book, that was a big deal, because I hadn't written a book before and I was a bit intimidated by the idea of it. I was thinking, well, it's, you know, it's a headline. How do you get a book out of a headline? There's been other times where I get contacts from victims a lot, from the people that the headlines are about. That's not uncommon. The first time that happened, it was a big thing, because it reminded me, not that I think I ever really forgot, but it just made it so real that these really are people. And when I talk to journalists about it and I tell them those stories about people reading their articles about something that was done to them and what that feels like, I understand it, but it can be easy to forget when you're a journalist that you're not just doing a job, you're talking about people's lives. And the things that you say and the things that you write and the things that you broadcast have a really long-lasting impact. And they also have an impact on the way everybody else responds to those stories. So, and all of this is about people, possibly what could be the worst moment in their entire lives. So I think that was probably the those ones are the ones that make me think, well, even if I ever wanted to give up on this, not that I did, but I don't think I could because of those.
Do you think that you'll keep doing this now for as, I don't know, as long as you can, keep fixing headlines and keep the campaign going as long as you can?
I think so. As I said, the any time I've been tempted to stop, there have been times where I've had to take a break from it because it does mean reading all those articles. It used to be every day, and it's just started to get a bit too much. You can't spend the first hour or two of your day reading articles about the worst things that people do to each other and maintain a clear view on the world. So I'm a lot more careful about how I do it now. I only keep it down to one or two days a week. And if it's getting too much for me, I will take a break for a few weeks. But no, I can't imagine while those headlines are still going out there. It would take a lot for me to get to the point of saying I don't care. Like I said, when you get contacts from the people that those headlines are about, it's pretty difficult to walk away from. I was thinking that I think it's 24 or 25, it'll be 10 years. Yeah. And maybe might be worth writing not another whole book, but maybe just a small follow-up book about what I've learned in 10 years, what I've learned even since I wrote the first book and where it's going to go from here. Yeah. So that's probably going to have me, I think when I get to the 10-year mark, that will probably have me thinking, all right, where do I take this from here? But I certainly expect to keep going until then.
I was just wondering, as a majoritively freelance writer, in knowing that the sort of things that you focus on is especially directed towards violence against women and these sorts of things and calling men out for the language that they use and that sort of thing, is that something that you get much pushback from when you're sort of directing your work towards certain companies and certain agencies, or is that something that compels people to maybe not take up work from you?
Look, I don't think I'm going to be getting a job at News Limited anytime soon, but that was probably going to be the case anyway. So that side of it doesn't bother me. I do sometimes think if I'm correcting a headline that's in a publication that I'm going to be pitching to, I kind of go, oh, wonder if this is going to get in the way. But I haven't ever had any problems with it. Mm-hmm. As I said, it's certainly in the early days, it was absolutely universal. It went across every single publication in Australia.
Yeah.
And I've never had anyone refuse to take commissions or not want me to write for them because they fixed it. Not that I know of anyway.
You talked about before, like, things that you've learned, I guess, since writing your last book and now potentially writing another one. Was there anything that you wanted to share that you've learned that has been something really valuable that you've learned after doing all of these headline changes?
A few things. I think the assumptions that journalists make about what people know, particularly about court processes and the limitations that they have when they're reporting it, that, you know, if you've got a long, say, a murder trial that's running for 3 weeks and your job is to report what happened in court that day and you don't put that context in to say this is one day out of a 3-week trial and, you know, here's links to the other reports from other days or other evidence was heard on other days, it can look really skewed. And often journalists, I think, forget that somebody that's sitting on the tram on their way to work or uni or school and reading one article doesn't have that bigger picture. And that can really skew people's views of the justice system and of journalism. So I think it's the assumptions that we make about what people know or what they understand are never useful in, like I said, in the purpose of the job, which is sharing information. I guess it's also shown me how really, really deeply ingrained the need to avoid holding men responsible for crimes that men commit. Not just the men that commit the crimes, but also the men around them, their friends and their colleagues and their companions, for holding them accountable for what they've done. And that ability to always move responsibility onto, oh, she was drunk, she was, did you see what she was wearing, she's a bit crazy, she's always been a liar, that kind of thing is so easy to fall into. And it's, I understand it, it's hard to think of your friends as people who can do terrible things. Nobody likes to believe that about people they care about, but that need to not ever look at it and see it for what it is so strong, far stronger, I think, than I knew before I started doing this.
We've got one last question for you, Jane. What can we do as young people to begin to deframe these stereotypes and conceptions?
I think the most powerful thing you can do amongst your own group of people that you mix in is stand up for people you don't like. It's really easy to stand up for our friends. We do it instinctively. But when somebody's saying something sexist about someone you don't like, when they're insulting them in ways that are gendered or based on the way they look or assumptions about their sexuality, standing up for people we don't like is incredibly powerful, because it's then it's about the principle. Then it's about saying this kind of behavior is just never okay. You can say you don't like someone. You can say that you think that they're boring or stupid or not very, you can say somebody's not very good at something, even insult them if you really feel the need to. And sometimes there is a need to, I understand that. But when people make the excuse that, oh, they're a terrible person or they've done a terrible thing, so it's okay for me to use those things that I actually know are wrong, like gendered insults or appearance-based or sexuality-based or, you know, race-based. It is never okay. If you think that is wrong, then it is always wrong. And standing up for people you don't like with people you do like, who like you, is possibly one of the hardest things but the most effective things, because that really does make that this is not okay absolutely true all the time. And we don't, if we only do it for people that we like, then it's not a principle, it's a friendship.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jane, for coming today and coming onto the podcast and for talking about your Fixed It project. It was really inspiring for all of us to hear about your perspective on everything. It's so refreshing to hear everything like that. So, yeah, thank you so much for coming to the Call It Out podcast with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me. It was really great.